Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, the campaign is heating up. Donald Trump still having to answer questions about his taxes. His surrogates say he is a genius. Hillary Clinton continues to slam him over that. We will talk with a Clinton campaign surrogate, former Jacksonville Mayor Alvin Brown. Also tonight, the two VP candidates for Clinton and Trump square off. Indiana Governor Mike Pence, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. We will talk about that debate as well. Plus, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump talks military veterans on the campaign trail. Folks are not happy about his comments about PTSD. We will talk to a retired general who was over the Army's human resources program. Also, a father of three who was wrongfully convicted, pleading for a pardon from Mike Pence. He's been cleared. Pardon board, unanimous. But Mike Pence still will not grant that pardon. We will talk with Keith Cooper about his efforts to clear his name. Also, box office roundup. How did movies starring African Americans do? And who the African Americans adorning the magazine covers in the month of October and November? We have all of that right here. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now TV One.
Genius loses $1 billion in a single year. This is Trump to a T. He's taken corporate excess and made a business model out of it. He abuses his power, games the system, puts his own interests ahead of the country's. It's Trump first and everyone else last.
That's almost $1 billion question Hillary Clinton is asking in Ohio. How did the one-time casino mogul Donald Trump lose $916 million in 1 year, assuring that he wouldn't be paying any taxes on future income for nearly 20 years? Yesterday, Donald Trump in Colorado admitted he exploited, quote, the system he calls unfair.
Fixing our broken tax code is one of the main reasons I'm running for president. I've been saying from the beginning of this campaign how ridiculous, complex, and yes, unfair the tax system is. It is an unfair system. I have a fiduciary responsibility to pay no more tax than is legally required, like anybody else. Or, put another way, to pay as little tax as legally possible.
Also had a responsibility not to lose $1 billion for all of his investors in his casino. He made money. They didn't. Now, while stumping in Ohio, where she's down 5 points, Clinton got a big endorsement from the king himself, NBA superstar LeBron James. In an op-ed posted in the Akron Beacon Journal, James wrote about the need for unity, quote, "We must address the violence of every kind the African-American community is experiencing in our streets and seeing on our TVs. We need a president who brings us together and keeps us unified. Policies and ideas that divide us more are not the solution. We must all stand together, no matter where we are from or the color of our skin. And Hillary is running on the message of hope and unity that we need."
I could not be prouder to have LeBron joining our team as we head into the home stretch. Now, one thing I know, but I'll just say it because I know it's for sure. I hope to be elected president, but I know here in Ohio, LeBron will always be the king.
Of course, we are 34 days away, and the DNC is launching a barrage of ads targeting African Americans and other minorities, including this radio ad featuring First Lady Michelle Obama.
We have to protect all the progress we've made together these past 8 years. And when our president and Congress is led by Democrats, that's exactly what they'll do. In this election, we can't just sit back and hope that everything works out for the best. The stakes are much too high.
Joining us via Skype from Brooklyn is Alvin Brown, a senior advisor to the Clinton campaign, also the former mayor of Jacksonville, Florida. We also reached out, folks, to the Trump campaign, as well as the Republican National Committee, to supply us someone from the campaign, and they simply did not come through. Alvin, I want to go to you. Clearly, when you look at polling data, we've talked about this for a month. New York Times had a story September 4th talking about the issue when it comes to lack of intensity among millennials, especially African Americans. And so we have seen this even now a month later. And so these ads using the First Lady targeting black media, you've had ads running in shows like Queen Sugar. I understand there'll be ads running also on TV One. The bottom line is the Clinton campaign needs a strong black turnout in order to beat back Donald Trump in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Florida, as well as other states.
Well, good morning, Roland Martin. It's good to be with you today. I can say this, you know, we know we have a lot of work to do with millennials. We're working hard every day, campaigning across the country, communicating with them, reaching out to them. You know, this has been a tough time for millennials in this country. They've entered the workforce during the worst time in the history in this country because of the recession. And so, you know, we're going to work hard to make sure we create opportunities for them. And that's why Secretary Clinton is not taking any vote for granted. And we have a lot of support. We're very honored to have the First Lady Michelle Obama campaigning on our behalf, the King himself, LeBron James. So it's going to take all of us together, working together to reach out to the millennials.
What is the actual message? Because again, saying vote against Trump is one thing, but having a message is another. Over the weekend, Angela Davis was at the Harry Belafonte Festival in Atlanta, where she talked about Democrat Party and Republican Party being tied to corporate interests. But she said she's not narcissistic enough with her ego to vote, basically to vote for Trump. She said it should be casting a vote against Trump. How do you make the case that it is about a message from Clinton as opposed to a not Trump vote?
Sure. I mean, it's very simple. I think the key is making sure that millennials know what we care about. She said that she'll be a fighter for them, focusing on making college affordable for all of the millennials, creating jobs, $20 billion to support youth unemployment, making sure at the end of the day that they will have access to capital and credit for those entrepreneurs, a $25 billion plan. A lot of millennials are big, want to be entrepreneurs, and that's what we're going to focus on. Drilling down on our message and making sure they know that she cares about them and she's going to do everything she can to make sure that they reach their God-given potential.
That was a 9-point gap between black men and black women voting for Obama in 2012. And I'm hearing the exact same thing. What specifically is the message to black men? I know on Sunday, Hillary Clinton sat down with a group of young black men when she was in Charlotte and when she spoke at the church there. How are you specifically targeting black men? We know black women turn out at a higher rate than anybody else in America in 2008-2012. How are you shoring up your black male numbers?
Well, I think black men, just like anybody else, you know, they want to be able to get a job, put food on a table, take care of their family, pay the bills. They want to be able to move up in this country. They want opportunities. They want to be the next great entrepreneur, doctors or lawyers. They want to be treated fair. And so Hillary policies speak directly to that. Even black men who have served their time, paid their debt to society, they want to be able to get out and get a job and housing and take care of their family. So she has set aside $5 billion for a reentry program to make sure that when they come out, they can get a job and provide housing. She want to make sure that African-American men have the opportunity to launch their own business, start their own business, and live the American dream. And we're going to work very hard to continue to reach out to them and speak to them. She sat down with some black men in Charlotte to listen to them, their concerns and issues. One of them is about the criminal justice system. And she talked about how important it is to make sure that we reform the system, like having a national guidelines to make sure that we know at the end of the day when law enforcement should use force and when they shouldn't. So it's all about making sure they know we care about them and reaching out to them and working together to improve the quality of life for all men, particularly African-American men.
Alvin Brown, we really appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to our panel. Brandon Cooper, Vice President of the Urban Conservative Project. Amber Phillips, Co-Director of Black and Huey Newsom, Contributor to Bold Media Group. Folks, you see the message dealing with taxes. You see how that is actually resonating among various voters. Donald Trump, Huey, cannot run away from this because he's been critical on the campaign trail of hedge funds and other people for not paying taxes. Now, all of a sudden, we're seeing this. He still refuses to release his taxes. To give the accurate information. I just don't see how you could say I am the messenger for the blue collar worker, the white working class worker, and I'm going to fix this when you are the prime example of somebody taking advantage of a situation.
Well, the fact that he in the past has taken advantage of a situation doesn't preclude the fact that he's the only one actually talking about tax reform. I mean, election after election after election, people give lip service to making the tax code fair for the working class. But at the end of the day, special interests come in. This even happened under the Obama administration. Special interests come in and make sure that their piece of the pie is still taken care of.
Okay, but he says, I'm going to do that. But how? Because the reality is this here. If you look at his tax cut plan, that's also going to benefit the rich and drive up the national debt.
But let's look at it, though. It's also going to be a lot simpler, right?
Okay,
so
okay,
right now you have loopholes the size that the trucks can drive through. And that's the problem.
Okay, hold on, stop. Uh-huh. Okay. It's going to be simpler, but still benefit the rich.
But
So I'm trying to understand, how is that fixing the tax code, if you say, well, it's simpler.
Yeah, but here's the problem.
What, a one-sheeter?
First of all, any tax reform is going to be beneficial to the rich because they pay most of the taxes.
70%.
So
Donald Trump is a representation that that's not true. Not only is he not paying taxes, but in the way he's in him running for president, he's stealing from the American people and asking for their support at the same time.
I will not defend Donald Trump in the past in terms of him being able to dodge paying taxes.
We're talking about 20 years.
No. Okay, we don't know that.
Right. And that's precisely the point. You've had candidates for 40 years. It's been practiced, Amber, releasing tax returns. He refuses to do so. Mm-hmm. He says he's under audit, but he has not released anything to actually prove he's under audit. Mm-hmm. And so what he's saying is, take my word. We can't take your word because when earlier you said, I'm going to release my taxes, you didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's robbing the American public. I don't think if you can't pay taxes, why do you get to be a leader of all these folks who are participating? I pay taxes. Why isn't Donald Trump? Because you created a couple of jobs, a handful, but you also are running to be the head of this nation. To me, it's absurd, and it's wild that he refuses to take accountability for it. Or if this is how he really feels, that the tax loopholes are so wide, why not just release your taxes and show us what's really going on?
Brandon, he's running as a businessman, hey, I'm the man, but here's the reality. It's $1 billion loss, $916 million, and the reality is this here. He made a ton of money during that period, had the shareholders of his company mm-hmm. pay for his yacht, pay for his plane, mm-hmm. pay for all those different things along those lines, paid his fees. They lost tons of money, so it actually undercuts the argument, I'm a great businessman, when you actually lost money for shareholders, mm-hmm. but you did well yourself personally.
Okay. And I call this guilt by, you know, accusation. There is nothing that he's done illegally. You can say that there's accusation. Okay,
sorry,
so there's no...
I'm sorry. I didn't say illegal.
Okay, let me finish. So he has followed the tax code, which he has been talking about reforming, as he made his statement saying earlier. He is the only candidate talking about reforming the tax code. And so these same kind of deductions, Hillary Clinton's tax returns, similar. She has taken advantage of many tax returns to reduce her property tax. She has received her seeking fees through a shell company in order to reduce her tax liability. Every American pays the lowest tax as possible under the law.
Okay,
and that is what Donald Trump has done.
I asked you, someone running as a, right. I'm a businessman, mm-hmm. and loses $1 billion, and he wants us to convince us I'm a great businessman, when reality, after he went through massive losses in the 80s with The Apprentice, what he actually did was simply license his name.
Right.
So this idea that I'm a great businessman, You license your name on a TV show.
Okay, yeah, and he has buildings in multiple cities across the country.
Hold on, one second. He's building in Las Vegas, licensing deal.
Oh, I understand.
No. When you say he has buildings in other places, there's a difference between, hold up, Brandon.
Yes, sir, I hear you.
Factually.
Yes, factually.
There's a difference between saying my company is actually building and constructing these projects as opposed to somebody's paying me to put my name on the building and they're actually doing
it.
Go ahead.
Buildings are like that. The one in D.C. that opened just a couple months ago is one that his company is operating with, the partnership of another company.
Right.
But I'm saying again,
that's one.
To say that 1 year term, anyone who knows business company, who owns a business, understand there is ups and downs. That's what happened. That's why the tax code allows for you to deduct losses when you lose a year.
Brandon, that was not one year.
What was released a year at times?
He lost money for a decade with his casinos. They filed bankruptcy.
You make money. That's what happens in business.
They filed bankruptcy four times.
The economy is not static. It goes up, it goes down. In the beginning of the 90s,
a casino?
Yes, Atlantic City. There are many casinos in Atlantic City that Donald Trump does not own that went bankrupt. So to blame that on him, that was the economy.
As a businessman, it wasn't the economy when he went in. He told the New Jersey folks that he was simply, banks love me. I hate junk bonds. I'm going to be able to get money. Then what happens when he actually got the license? He couldn't get financing from the banks. And then he actually had to use junk bonds. He was over leveraged from day one. What it required to keep the doors open every day, they would have had to generate anywhere from $1.3 to $1.8 million a day, which everybody in Atlanta City said is unheard of. That's called bad business.
You can cherry pick parts of his business.
He makes
tens of thousands of jobs he's made. What has Hillary Clinton made as far as jobs?
So tens of thousands of jobs?
Tens of thousands over his career, over the past 30 years.
Okay, I'll see, here's the deal. So you want me to accept the tens of thousands of jobs over 30 years, but you don't want to accept the billions he lost in 10 years.
That's what happened with business. Up and down. There's no business America. Anybody watching would not go up and down.
Before I go to my next topic, go ahead.
I'm not going to defend Donald Trump.
But again, all of this does not preclude the fact that we need changes in the tax code.
And we also,
all this, we would just heard the mayor talking about business and entrepreneurship and all that sort of thing. Here's the question. How are businesses going to flourish if we don't have a tax code that works for business?
Actually, this tax code is working very well because... just said it's not working for businesses. It's working it worked real well for Donald Trump. Speaking of working well for Donald Trump, another story, the Associated Press has broken down a story dealing with Donald Trump making lewd and sexist comments about women while he was the TV boss on NBC's reality show The Apprentice. The accusations come at a time when Trump was embroiled in controversies involving women he publicly insulted. The AP interviewed nearly two dozen people, including crew members, editors, and contestants, who all recounted similar experiences with Trump. 12 of them spoke on the record. They describe a man who did not treat women professionally, made inappropriate comments that embarrassed and demeaned them. Now, the show debuted in 2004, became a big hit, spinning off into Celebrity Apprentice. It catapulted Trump into reality stardom, which helped launch his political ambitions, but also improved his business because he was going broke. In a statement, campaign spokeswoman Hope Hicks denied the charges, saying, quote, "These outlandish, unsubstantiated, and totally false claims fabricated by publicity-hungry, opportunistic, disgruntled former employees have no merit whatsoever." Well, one of the folks is Marshawn Evans, who was on The Apprentice, was a contestant, also a former Miss America. She joins us right now. Marshawn, when you read this story, Donald Trump would say in front of women, he would remark about their breasts, he would talk about their butt, he would even say to other crew members, "Hey, would you like to sleep with her? I would love to." These crew members said he said these things while cameras were rolling. Your thoughts, your experiences with Donald Trump on The Apprentice?
Well, I was on very early when it was the original Apprentice in season 4 back in 2005, and that was certainly very similar to my experience to a certain extent. When we interviewed, my cast was the first cast that personally interviewed with Donald Trump in a hotel room, mind you, and the casting directors were very specific about the clothes that we would wear. They came to my hotel room, made sure that I had the shoes and the dress and the style that would fit what they called was the Trump brand. And so there was an expectation and an understanding, and actually we were encouraged to be sexy, to be stylish, if you will. It's not the same type of expectation you would have in working for a job. But I didn't have any, I would say, negative interactions with Donald in a way that he was offensive to me, but he always made comments about women. This is a man who has more in common with Hugh Hefner than he does with Bloomberg or Warren Buffett. Yes, he has made a lot of money, depending on how you look at if your wealth is based off of what you make or what you keep, but he loves casinos, he loves women, and he loves money, and that's always who he has been. It wasn't that I was unaware of that when I did The Apprentice, because he's an entertainer. And there's a difference between being an entertainer and then a person of excellence. And that's really where the breakdown is happening right now.
One woman was quoted on the records, Trump's had her twirl around so he could take a look at her body. She said, well, it really wasn't that big of a deal. There were other crew members who said he often remarked about one crew member, one camera operator, her butt, saying she had a very nice butt and made her uncomfortable. He would constantly make comments about her body.
Well, he's very, he loves women. We see that in the fact that he's had multiple marriages, but we see that also in the choices of the industries he's chosen to be in. And I'm not surprised about that. Again, I experienced that, but we kind of wrote it off when we were on the show because, again, it was entertainment. None of us were actually applying to work for Donald Trump or working for the Trump organization. The Apprentice was a game show. When you win, or even if you don't win, all of us that receive money from being on the show receive checks from NBC, not the Trump organization. We knew that this was entertainment. We knew that he's an entertainer. And I believe what's making him successful in this campaign, if you call it success, I think it's dangerous, is that he's an expert marketer. He's an expert at publicizing himself. He shares that in common with Kim Kardashian. And in this entertainment-driven society, I think what we really got to look at is what's the danger of Kardashianism-style leadership, which is really what Trump is representing, on women, on young girls. I run a very large company, one of the largest coaching companies for women in the country. Working with women to be successful in business, in the marketplace, to build million-dollar enterprises for themselves. My concern is, what does this do for women in terms of our opportunities to be taken seriously? Mm-hmm. When you look at Donald Trump interrupting Secretary Clinton over 50 times, it shows that we are going backwards in terms of whether or not women's views are going to even be listened to. You don't have to agree with them.
Got it.
But can a woman finish a sentence, please? So that idea and what that does subconsciously to other young men and men who are currently in corporate America and how women are treated subconsciously and explicitly, I think we're going backwards.
All right. Marshawn Lynch, we truly appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Tonight, VP nominees Tim Kaine, Senator Tim Kaine, Governor Mike Pence will get ready to do battle in their only debate. We will talk about their particular debate later in the show. We'll talk to a black man who's been desperately trying to get his pardon, but Pence refuses to sign it, even though he is absolutely innocent. All of that next, News 1 Now, TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Tonight, VP nominee Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, Indiana Governor Mike Pence will square off in the only debate of this season. The debate will be held at Farmville, Virginia. Kaine, of course, is at Longwood University. Kaine, of course, is running along with Hillary Clinton. Pence running along with Donald Trump. As they prepare, Republicans are under fire for launching a new web ad attacking Tim Kaine. It seems to recall the infamous 1988 Willie Horton attack ad on Democratic nominee Michael Dukakis, which was criticized for its racial undertones. Later, the Lee Atwater even apologized for that ad. The GOP ad titled America Deserves Better highlights Kaine's complicated relationship with the capital punishment. Check this out.
When you want to know something about the character of somebody in public life, look to see if they have a passion that began long before they were in office, and that they have consistently held it throughout their career.
Long before Tim Kaine was in office, he consistently protected the worst kinds of people. Lem Tuggle raped, sodomized, and murdered Jesse Geneva Havens after being paroled for murdering a 17-year-old girl. Tim Kaine defended him. Richard Lee Whitley sexually assaulted and murdered his elderly neighbor. Tim Kaine defended him. Outside Whitley's execution, Tim Kaine said, "Something personal in me will die with Whitley." Percy Walton brutally murdered three people. As governor, Tim Kaine commuted his sentence, citing concerns disproved by the courts. Jens Søring and his girlfriend murdered Derek and Nancy Haysom, stabbing them to death in their home. On his last day as governor, Tim Kaine tried to have Søring sent to Germany, where parole would have been possible.
Now, the Republican Party's chief strategist in the GOP, Sean Spicer, tweeted a link to the roll call story, which described the ad as Willie Horton style. Do we have the tweet, folks? You should have the tweet. But after an outpouring of criticism, the tweets were deleted. A spokesman for the Clinton campaign called the ad a shameful attack. Now, the question is, does it go too far? We'll break it down with our panel as well, Brandon Cooper of Amber Phillips, as well as Huey Newsom. So, folks, your thoughts about the ad?
I think, first of all, comparing it to the 1988 Willie Horton ad, I mean, you can see that the racial undertones that we saw in the 88 Horton ad aren't quite there. You got white and black offenders. So my question is, the question of capital punishment is legitimate in terms of public policy, and I think it raises those questions. But at the same time, to say that this has those racial undertones that we saw in 1988, I think that's just driving divisiveness.
I'm very curious, Brandon. Are Republicans saying that individuals who've been accused of crimes don't need defense attorneys?
Not at all. I don't think that's the case.
But here's the deal, though.
Yeah.
The ad is basically saying, Tim Kaine, you defended these people. He was a defense attorney. Mm-hmm. The Constitution, the actual Constitution, says anybody accused of a crime has a right to a lawyer. In fact, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts worked on death penalty cases.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't think that's what the Republican Party is saying, nor do I think that's what the ad is saying. I think that they're talking about some of the comments he made while he was a defense attorney for that client, and particularly when he was governor, and the action he took with Søring, who was, evidence is clear, murdered two individuals here in the state and the country, and was trying to commute a sentence and send them back. So it was more so about his decision, not so much his act of being a defense attorney, but some of the comments he made.
No, but the ad said he defended this person.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He defended this person,
and Amber. I'm not defending the ad and write the ad. I don't think it's a really effective ad. I think it's, my position on death penalty is kind of opposition to that. But what I'm saying, again, if you look at the ad, it was not saying, like you said, or you started off, that him being a defense attorney was the issue. It was the comments he made when he was a defense attorney.
Amber.
Comments and he did
as someone who's just watching the ad, just as like a millennial, it definitely read as this man showed up to work every day and did his job. We know our criminal justice system, of course, needs reform, and there's a lot to be done there. But I'm really heartbroken by this election in general about the levels of which the Republican Party and Donald Trump will take, and how Republicans keep speaking out against him, but will, especially in this setting, like a lot of folks will say, oh, I'm not supporting Donald Trump, but I'm also not taking a stand to vote in opposition of him if this is the type of person he has shown himself to be. So I don't know what the Republican Party's responsibility is to actually voting their values to not make sure that this man gets into the White House.
And one quick point before you go. I think Brandon's dead on. I think that the ad is troublesome in so many regards. However, to say that it's racially divisive is disingenuous, and I think it overplays racial divisiveness in this country. And we already know that we have enough of that. We have too much already in that regard. We don't need more divisiveness.
Well, one of the issues that might come up tonight, of course, if Mike Pence decides to hit him on this issue, will be issue we're going to talk about next. And we'll talk with a guy who was declared guilty, served time, later found innocent. Pardons board, unanimous, guy deserves a pardon, but Mike Pence, the VP nominee as governor, still refuses to grant this guy a pardon in the face of all evidence that clearly said he's innocent. We're going to talk with that man next. Also, Donald Trump has some issues when it comes to military veterans with PTSD. A lot of veterans are not happy with what he had to say about that. We'll break that down on the show as well. All of that, News One Now, TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
I feel like I was robbed, and I feel like nobody's paying for it. Someone should be paying for it. Because if my dad was there, I would have never went through that.
That's the daughter of Keith Cooper, a father of three who spent 10 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. Cooper's now requesting a new trial after exhausting all of his options for a pardon from Indiana Governor Mike Pence. This all started back in 1996 when Cooper was wrongfully convicted for robbery and attempted murder. With the help of DNA evidence, Cooper was freed, but only if he agreed to have a felony on his record. In 2014, the Indiana Parole Board recommended a pardon for Cooper. It was a unanimous vote. Yet last month, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, Donald Trump's VP nominee, told Cooper to try to pursue exoneration through the courts, which is now why Cooper and his attorney have requested a new trial. Joining us via FaceTime in Chicago is Keith Cooper and his attorney, Elliot Slauzer. Keith, you see this guy running for vice president of the United States with Donald Trump. It is abundantly clear you did not do it. His own parole board, unanimous vote, says issue a pardon. Normally, governors across the state will listen to their parole board, who are their appointees. Do you believe that you are being caught up in election year politics?
Yes.
Mike, do you believe that Mike Pence, since his term will be up in January, win or lose, is trying to pass this off to the next governor?
Yes, I believe so.
And are you hopeful that tonight, in tonight's debate, that Senator Tim Kaine might bring up your case to Governor Pence and ask him why is it that he will not issue this pardon?
Well, I'm looking forward to Kaine bringing this subject up, because I've waited too long and I feel as though I need an answer to why he putting it off.
Now, you spent 10 years in prison. When were you released?
2006.
So you were released in 2006, under probation?
No, the time served.
So you released time served.
Right.
So by having a trial, to your attorney, what does that actually do? What does it achieve?
It's just a long due process, which can take up to another year or so.
And so you're having to go through this. Elliot, speak to this here. So, Elliot, going through a trial achieves what for Keith?
Sure. So, what we've asked the court yesterday in our filing is to grant Keith a new trial. I mean, that creates a whole host of issues, because if we win him a new trial, theoretically, the state can ask for Keith to actually be incarcerated pending trial because he originally had a bond. And then we're potentially left with going to a trial and presenting our case. We're very confident in our case that we'd win. But obviously, you can never depend on what a judge or jurors are going to do. He was wrongfully convicted once, and surely, the prosecutors could try to do that again.
Elliot, here you also have Pence, who is a fiscal conservative. I mean, the state is spending thousands upon thousands of dollars to go through a legal process for a man who is innocent, and the pardon board said, issue a pardon.
Yeah, I mean, it's really shocking. Frankly, I've never encountered a case with as much evidence of innocence as this case has. We thought that when the trial prosecutor wrote a letter to Governor Pence urging him to grant the pardon for Keith, we thought that that would have been the end. Because never before have I seen the person who wrongfully convicted somebody who was innocent say, I did it, I made a mistake, and you can fix it. And even with all of that, Governor Pence decided to ignore those letters and punt the issue because it's election season and he is running for vice president, and the elected prosecutor from the county where Keith was convicted is running for attorney general in Indiana.
And so with that, there's no doubt in your mind, this is all politics.
This is all politics. That's all it is. Days after that letter was sent, I got another phone call from somebody on Pence's staff, which essentially confirmed that the media was getting too hot for them to handle, and that they needed to, you know, put out a public response.
Are you also, Keith, are you also suing the state for compensation for being wrongfully imprisoned?
So Keith actually can't sue the state until his wrongful conviction is reversed. He's actually barred from doing so.
Wait a minute. So until he's either, so until he's pardoned or you get to go through this trial, he can't even get sue them for damages.
Exactly, yeah. So either way, you know, either the governor can formally grant a pardon based upon actual innocence, and, you know, at that point, Keith would be able to file a lawsuit if he were so inclined. Or if we went through the court process and we not only got him a new trial, but the charges were dismissed or he was acquitted, at that point, he would be able to file a lawsuit. And I imagine that that's something that these public officials are very much thinking about, even though in reality, Keith is really just trying to clear his name right now.
And Keith, you have a felony on your record, which means you can't vote.
Well, I can vote in here in Illinois, and I found out I can vote in Indiana, but other states I can't.
Gotcha. Gentlemen, we certainly appreciate it. I certainly hope Senator Tim Kaine brings this up tonight in the debate.
Thank you so much.
Quickly want to go to our panel here. To my two conservatives, what the hell?
I mean,
a pardon board, unanimous. The prosecutor in the case says, I made a mistake, and Governor Mike Pence still refuses to give a pardon?
No, I think that's indefensible, unfortunately. I mean, I'd have to understand, you know, his side of the story and, you know, understand that more. But based on the facts I know,
his side of the story is what they did, what he said. If you want exoneration, go get it through the court system.
And I think part of that might be due process. But unfortunately, I can't speak to that because
what do you mean? What due process?
Because
you already due process is also I have a pardon board that which I appoint. A pardon board whose job is to actually make pardon decisions.
Yes.
That's due process.
But a pardon, and again, I'm not defending it, but a pardon is different than being than clearing your record of the felony.
He didn't do it!
I understand that.
The prosecutor, the person who did it, said, we messed up. Grant this man a pardon.
I understand that, but the due process of the judicial system.
It's also clear that these two folks who are running for office have no investment in this community, have no investment in Americans.
No argument.
They are going, he is literally, we just heard a story about a man who is literally caught up in a system, and people who have the power to do something about it are choosing not only to not do anything, to say yes or no, but to just sit there on their hands.
I think it's important to highlight, you know, again, it's indefensible. I don't understand if I was governor of Indiana, need to issue a pardon, but there's another route, a judicial route, which the courts could evaluate, which I've been happy, has happened before, is not nothing that's unheard of. There's two actions and go through to have this.
Dude, he has to spend money on an attorney. He has to go through a process.
Yes.
If you are a fiscal conservative, why would you sit here and allow to go through a year of another legal battle when all the governor has to do is simply get a sheet of paper, get a pen, and sign it, he's done, the courts are done, you save money, and you can move on.
And we're on this issue. Again, I said again, he should sign it. I have no idea why he's not. It's confusing to me. He needs to sign the pardon book.
I don't want to hear that crap about, there's a process, can go to court.
But I'm saying to her point about the system, I think it's also important to realize who had a hand in creating the system that has this man locked up. And you want to talk about Clinton's support of the crime?
Pence is definitely a part of that system.
Okay. And
so, wait a minute, hold up. You trying to link the Clinton crime bill to this guy?
No, I just said that this guy should be pardoned. Again, he
Brandon,
should be pardoned.
Brandon, the system, the prison system was created long before Bill Clinton became president.
And I said, you don't want
Brandon, what you're not going to do on this show is try to spin this. Brandon, you are not going to try to spin this, let me tie it to Bill Clinton. Here's the deal. Governor Mike Pence, right now, Leave it at that. Yeah. Don't try the rest of that crap.
I'm talking about the election.
No. Yeah. I'm talking about this case.
He needs to be pardoned.
Don't try that crap because, see, that's weak.
He needs to be pardoned.
That's weak.
It.
Thank you. Leave it right there.
Yes, sir.
Don't try the rest of that crap. That's weak.
I'm talking about the election.
We come back. Speaking of weak, Donald Trump says veterans who have PTSD, some are weak, some are strong. A lot of veterans not happy. We'll talk to a retired general who dealt with this issue a lot in the U.S. Army. Plus, former Congressman Chaka Patel will give an update on his robbery conviction. All that, News 1 Now, TV 1.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
Today, former Congressman Chaka Patel was supposed to be sentenced after being convicted on 22 counts of robbery, but due to the Supreme Court decision of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell when he was actually let go, Patel is appealing his conviction based upon that particular ruling. As a result, he will not be sentenced today. Of course, the former Democratic congressman lawyers say the high court narrowed the definition of bribery after overturning that conviction of Bob McDonnell. Of course, it was Patel was convicted of accepting gifts from a businessman in exchange for hiring the man's girlfriend and pressing the White House to make him an ambassador. Patel's attorneys argued the congressman accepted the gifts out of friendship and that that's what congressmen do, set up various meetings. As the judge reviews the appeal, the sentencing again for Patel and four co-defendants will be put on hold. Meanwhile, Patel's son is serving a five-year prison sentence in a bank and tax fraud case. All right, folks, also in dealing with politics, Donald Trump made some comments yesterday that have unsettled veterans. The question came up dealing with the issue of PTSD. Here's what Donald had to say.
When you talk about the mental health problems, when people come back from war and combat and they see things that maybe a lot of the folks in this room have seen many times over and you're strong and you can handle it, but a lot of people can't handle it. And they see horror stories, they see events that you couldn't see in a movie, nobody would believe it. Now, we need a mental health help and medical, and it's one of the things that I think is least addressed, and it's one of the things that I hear, like your question, it's one of the things that I hear the most about when I go around and talk to the veterans. So we're going to have a very, very robust level of performance having to do with mental health. We are losing so many great people that can be taken care of if they have proper care.
A lot of veterans took offense to that by saying strong can handle it, some can't. And Paul Rykoff of IAVA sent a tweet out talking about President Obama last week in a town hall where he answered the same question. And he said, this is how a commander-in-chief should answer that question.
I have instructed the Joint Chiefs and up and down the chain of command that they have a responsibility to destigmatize mental health issues and issues of PTSD and help to explain to everybody in all of the units under their command that there's nothing weak about asking for help. If you break your leg, you're going to go to a doctor to get that leg healed. If, as a consequence of the extraordinary stress and pain that you are witnessing typically in a battlefield, something inside you feels like it's wounded, it's just like a physical injury. You got to go get help. And there's nothing weak about that. That's strong.
Joining us is retired U.S. Army General, Major General John Hawkins III. He, of course, served in the U.S. Army. General, you actually had to deal with this issue in your capacity with the Army. How would you judge how Trump answered that question? Even though his supporters say, look, he wasn't condemning troops, many still said when you say some of this room were strong, could handle it, some couldn't, they say that's problematic language.
Well, I agree. I think that it's very problematic on many different fronts. First of all, the National Institute of Health and the Veterans Administration have all agreed that PTS is not something that involves strength over weakness or weakness over strength. So that factually is wrong, which brings me to the second issue that concerns me most. Not only is the concern of stigma a reason why most soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, and Coast Guardsmen and women do not seek help because of the fear that someone will view them as being weak. And then it goes untreated. But it's also very strange that someone should equate PTS with being weak and say that as a potential spokesperson for the most powerful nation in the world, the most powerful military in the world. You cannot make statements that are not based upon fact if you represent the most powerful nation in the world. When a general officer or an admiral or a commander of all troops, the commander in chief, makes a statement, a judgment, that must be based upon fact, not supposition. When you say something and it is hurtful or it is wrong, you can apologize till the cows come home. You've said it. And now you've created actually fertile ground for folks to say, don't join the military, don't get in the military, because you're going to be viewed as weak if you come out. 30%+ of people serving or that have served fall into the category of having some form of PTS. Not only that, 37%+ of firefighters today have PTS. Are they weak? Are they not strong? I don't understand where that kind of comment comes from. I can only surmise that it comes from the same lack of information that believes that admirals and generals today are quote unquote rubble.
And he made the comment about how he's going to have a strong mental health plan in about 45 seconds. Just give our folks a sense of, again, where the military is right now in dealing with this issue, because this has been a major, major point over the last 5 to 8 years.
Well, for instance, the Army, the current Surgeon General, Lieutenant General Nadja West, native Washingtonian, who sort of, to use an overly used expression, bootstrapped herself up to the top, is paying specific and great attention to the mental health issues. We have found that many things that manifest themselves in physical problems at some point in time actually start in issues between the ears. So a great deal of attention is being paid to that. The Veterans Administration is a very robust program filled with PhD folks working on that very issue. I would think that someone seeking to be commander-in-chief or should one become commander-in-chief would only support those activities and certainly not try to chastise people that suffer from an injury.
All right, General Hawkins, we appreciate it. Thanks so much. We come back, box office report, but also what the Black Folks magazine covers this month. We'll give you a rundown. All of that next, News One Now, TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
All right, folks, box office roundup. The Magnificent Seven starring Denzel Washington came in number 3 this weekend with $15.6 million. It has grossed so far $61.5 million in its second week of release. Of course, it is a remake of the 1960 classic Western film. Of course, also directed by Antoine Fuqua. Those two have done several movies together. Jumping up to number 7 this weekend, Queen of Katwe, adding over 1,000 screens in its second week, brought a weekend total to $2.4 million, up 755% in terms of the screens. It is based on the true story of a 10-year-old girl from the slums of Uganda who uses the game of chess to escape a life of poverty. Starring Lupita Nyong'o, David Oyelowo, and Medina Nalwanga. Suicide Squad, featuring Will Smith, slots at number 11 in its ninth week in theaters. It grossed $1.9 million, but over $320 million since its release, making it one of the highest grossing films of the summer. Two spots down, number 13, When the Bow Breaks, coming in at $1.1 million for a total of $28.5 million. Of course, the suspense thriller features Morris Chestnut, Regina Hall, and Jazz Sinclair. All right, folks, are you curious to see who is gracing the covers of October magazines? Well, check this out. President Barack Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama on the covers of Essence. The First Lady, she could fly solo on the cover of Style. Kevin Hart adorns Ebony magazine. Lupita Nyong'o, she is featured on Vogue. Also on the cover of Time Out, UK. Kerry Washington, my homegirl, she covers The Hollywood Reporter with fashion designer Christian Louboutin with the red sole shoes. And Halle Berry is on the cover of W Royals magazine. Kanye West also adorns W Royals magazine. Taraji Henson, Red Book. Chanel, Iman, Harper's Bazaar, Kazakhstan. We've been all the way over there.
All right.
Model Joan Smalls covers both Glamour and Harper's Bazaar, España. Model Jordan Dunn covers El Brasil. And Tinashe is on the cover of Nylon magazine. Willow Smith on the cover of Dazed. And actor John Boyega covers GQ UK. Folks, want to take a moment to pay tribute to award-winning author Gloria Naylor, who died on September 28th. Naylor's sister told Ebony Magazine the author passed away after suffering a heart attack. She's the critically acclaimed author of many books, known for stories dealing with complex and multi-layered lives of African-American women. Her best-known work was the 1982 book, The Women of Brewster Place, which went on to win the National Book Award and became a television miniseries produced by Oprah Winfrey and starring Oprah, including Cicely Tyson and Robin Givens. Gloria Naylor had been living in the Virgin Islands at the time of her death. She was 66 years old. We'll be back. News 1 Now.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin. Every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
Birthday shout out time. Rapper Rich Homie Quan turns 27. Really? You know who that is, Amber?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, no, you don't. NBA star Derrick Rose turns 28. Entrepreneur Russell Simmons turns 59. Clifton Davis, Alpha Man Huey, turns 71. On this day in history, in 1996, Congress passes a bill authorizing the creation of 500,000 Black Revolutionary War Patriots commemorative coins. All right, folks, now tomorrow on News 1 Now, full recap and analysis of the VP debate between Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, plus it's also Wildin' Out Wednesday. You don't want to miss all of that. Folks, you can always hit me on Twitter at Roland S. Martin or go to our News 1 Facebook page. And also, don't forget, Friday we'll have our one-hour special on the Many Rivers to Cross Festival that took place in Atlanta. Led by Harriet Belafonte, Man Common, John Legend, so many stars were there, Maxwell as well. You don't want to miss that. Folks, I got to go. Holla!
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.